Welcome to What's for Dinner, a radio show about food, cooking, and eating, and sharing favorite recipes from Petersburg, Alaska, and around the world. Brought to you by KFSK Community Supported Radio in Petersburg, Alaska. I'm your host, Mindy Anderson. Coming up today on What's for Dinner, Sunday dinner, also cooking with spirits. But first, a conversation with Heather Shade from the Port Chilkoot Distillery in Haines and My Sweet Tooth. All this is coming up. Support for What's for Dinner on KFSK comes from Hammer & Weekon Grocery Store, offering an expanded organic produce selection, deli, bakery, and meat department, with delivery and van service available. Hammer & Weekon Grocery Store, a Petersburg family-owned business since 1921. Welcome back to What's for Dinner. I'm Mindy Anderson, your host. I'm not a chef. I just love to cook. Sometimes I cook real flops. And I usually start the show off talking about, well, basically what I cooked through the week. Maybe a few good recipes and maybe one that turned out bad. I don't usually give you the bad ones, though, right? But made a couple good things this weekend. Last night we had a great fettuccine Alfredo, chicken fettuccine Alfredo, which my daughter said was the best she's ever had. And she loves pasta with cream sauce, so that was good. That was not a flop. I also made some homemade pretzels with a Szechuan salt, so it's kind of a spicy salt mixture, and then a sharp spicy cheese sauce. That was good. And then also this weekend I made creamy halibut chowder. So let's just start off with maybe the pretzels. You know, you don't have to, well, you do need to start off with some bread dough. And because I'm not going to go through a whole a lot of time just giving you the recipe for making bread or bread dough, if you are somebody who does make bread dough, then making pretzels, it's pretty easy. If you're not someone who likes to make bread dough, you can always go to the grocery store and pick up the frozen Rhodes bread, and you just get the, you know, the dinner rolls. You can get the large ones or the small ones, whichever you want, and just thaw those out and let those rise. Generally, a pretzel is more of a drier bread dough, but I just used my basic bread dough recipe yesterday and used that to make some pretzels. I just added, as I was, you know, I let the dough rise and then I was cutting it into smaller pieces for pretzels. And then I just kneaded in a little bit more flour. And my dough is really, really springy and moist. So I had a hard time getting the pretzel shape that I wanted. And I guess I could have kept rolling. You want about a 30-inch long rope of dough. But I just decided, you know what, it doesn't really matter what the pretzels look like as long as they taste good. So I kind of, you know, wove them around into somewhat of a pretzel shape. But they were a lot thicker than a normal pretzel you would buy anywhere else, or, you know, like the store-bought kind, or you know what I mean. And they were delicious, though. So I just, you just need to boil some water. I added some salt to my water, so it was a nice salty water. And Then once I had my dough in the shape that I wanted it, I also experimented making like little pretzel buns. Let's say you wanted to make like an interesting hamburger or, you know, like an butterflied sausage sandwich on a pretzel bun. I wanted to try to make a pretzel bun, and that turned out great too. So anyway, you just take your pretzel that you've shaped with your dough and put it in the boiling water for about 30 seconds. It doesn't take long. It's going to drop to the bottom, or at least mine did, and then they float right to the top. So pretty much shortly after they float to the top, I took mine out with a slotted spoon, and I laid them on a piece of parchment that was on a baking sheet, had some olive oil on it, and a couple of egg yolks mixed with a little bit of water, brush that on, and then sprinkle on your salt. And I used a nice spicy with Szechuan pepper and a nice coarser salt blend. You want coarser salt. You could use kosher salt. That would be fine too. Just don't use table salt, and don't use like a very fine sea salt. You want something that has some crunch to it that you're going to bite into. And then put it in the oven on like 450, 425 for about 15, 20 minutes, and they'll get nice and golden brown. I probably didn't leave mine in long enough to get the golden brown color that I wanted, but they were still nice and crispy on the outside, and then they were chewy on the inside, and they had that nice rubbery coating, you know, that a pretzel has. So I enjoyed them. I thought they were great. And then I made I couldn't have the pretzels without some spicy cheese sauce, so I had some sharp cheddar in the refrigerator, and it was Tillamook, extra sharp actually. So in a little saucepan, just a couple pads of butter, a couple tablespoons of butter, maybe not quite two tablespoons, but close to it, and let that melt, and then go ahead and add in a tablespoon of flour. You can eyeball it. It's fine. You just want that to bubble up and get that nutty smell to it, and it'll start to thicken up, and it's just a nice roux. And I add salt and pepper immediately to that. And then from there, I just added the first thing I grabbed out of the fridge, which could have been, you know, it was right there. So I had milk, I had half and half, and I actually had some whipping cream. I had all three of those. I think I just grabbed the half and half and poured some of that in there, and it made a nice, thick sauce, white sauce. And you want it to be, you know, not too thin, but not thick like a paste either. So if it's too thick, add a little bit more cream to it. And then I added, I just shredded cheese, probably a cup and a half of cheese, maybe a little bit more. And there you have it. Just let the cheese melt and keep stirring it to get out all of the lumps, and you want it to be nice and creamy. Salt and pepper to taste. I added some red pepper flakes. I also added some Bojie's stone ground mustard and a little bit of Worcestershire sauce to it. Just sprinkle in. I gave it a taste. You know, that gives it that special saltiness, but you know, it also has that exoticness to it. So, don't forget about Worcestershire. Sometimes it sits in the back of your refrigerator or on your refrigerator door, and you forget about it, but it really can spice up certain foods, especially foods that you're using, like it's a cream, or especially, well, I used it in my halibut chowder that I'm going to talk about in just a little bit, but... And that was basically it. If you want it to be spicier, you can add some more spice to it. If you want it to be cheesier, just add a little more cheese, and you can keep it on heat and low on low, or you can take it off the heat, and yes, it will solidify. But when you're ready just to use it again, just put it back on the heat and slowly warm it back up, or you can microwave it a little bit. So that was a really great treat yesterday. We all enjoyed that. And then last night, I made a chicken fettuccine Alfredo. I bought one package of chicken breasts. So it was one breast, basically. You had the two sides, two halves, and I cut those up into strips about 2 inches long and just set them aside on a plate with some salt and pepper. I didn't dip them in flour or anything like that, just a little salt and pepper. And then I used, of course, fettuccine. And there is a pasta sale happening up at Hammer and Wecon, so I, you know, bought a couple. You know, we love pasta at my house. I could never give it up, really. So I bought a couple different things. And when I like to cook the fettuccine, and I made sure I did this last night, I did not overcook the fettuccine. And usually I'm super particular and picky about not overcooking pasta when I'm cooking with it. But last night, I really wanted it to have that al dente bite to it. Because then, you know, the cream sauce, and it just makes for a thick pasta, and you bite into it, and it doesn't fall apart, and you really can chew on the pasta. I love that. So once again, you're salting your water and throw your pasta in and, you know, stir it up a couple times. Don't walk away from it too long. Keep testing it until it's at where you want it to be. But getting back to the sauce, in a cast iron skillet, I added a little bit of olive oil and a little bit of butter and threw in a half of an onion, chopped pretty fine, to give it that little caramelization under onion taste to it. Also some salt and pepper. And delish. Then I added one huge garlic clove. I think it was a garlic clove. It was either from Sharon Sprague or it was from Farragut Farm, I think. Huge. And chopped that up. Just fresh and moist, and the juice was just running out of it. And chopped that up, threw that in there, pretty fine. And then I threw in the chicken. And so right away the chicken's going to release some of its moisture as well as it starts to cook up. And it really doesn't take that long. So once the chicken is browned, pretty much, I mean, it doesn't really need to cook that long, 'cause it's going to cook again when you put it in with the pasta. And then I just add I opened up a bottle of Chardonnay and about a half a cup of wine to that. Let it deglaze a little bit, and you've got this really nice onion, garlic, chicken, white wine sauce. That's what you've got so far in the cast iron skillet. And then take it off the heat and let it sit. So good. And then I added a little chopped parsley to that, set it aside. Then when your pasta is done, use your pasta spoon or your tongs and lift the pasta out a little at a time and back into the cast iron skillet. Turn it back on. Maybe your timing was perfect and you didn't really even have to take it off the heat at all, but put the sauce back on. And put your pasta in there, mix it just a little bit, and then put in, I don't want to use milk, because if milk starts to boil, you know what happens. It separates. And, you know, it's not good. So I used half and half for that. And I put in a little bit of half and half until it was the consistency that I wanted it to. And let that simmer and start to thicken with the pasta. And, you know, it doesn't take long because you've got the starch from the pasta coming off and everything thickens pretty quickly. And give it a little bit of toss. And I had Romano cheese. I shredded a good cup and a half of that, put that in there. And then I also had, I had some pre-grated Parmesan cheese, finely grated Parmesan cheese that I also put in there, probably another half of a cup. But it was rich and it was creamy and it was so good. And then there at the end, after the cheese is melted, it's nice and thick. If you think you need more moisture to it, you can just scoop out some of the pasta water and add it right to your pasta. And that will thin it out a little bit and still make sure it has a lot of flavor. And then sprinkle on some fresh grated cheese on the top and a little bit more parsley, and you're done. Voila. I served mine in some wide, shallow soup bowls last night, and it was delicious. I don't think anybody ate too much, but it was good. It was hearty. It was delicious. Just what Evelyn wanted and just what we all wanted. We all love that. But I have to say, it was really good, chicken fettuccine Alfredo. So I made a good leftover today for Evelyn's lunch, and I'm sure there's still more left. Also this weekend, I made some creamy halibut chowder, and I've given you my clam chowder recipe a lot, and this is pretty much the same. You know, I usually use bacon to start with, and I cut it up nice and small. I put the bacon in my cast iron pot, and cook that down, and then set it aside on a paper towel to drain. And I pour off some of the bacon drippings and use the rest of it to cook the onion and the potato and the celery and carrot. In my chowder, I always put carrot in there. I love the flavor and the color. So pour a little bit of the bacon grease off. This is for halibut chowder. Pour a little of the bacon grease off into a cast iron skillet. And then save the rest of it. Well, you already used your cast iron skillet to cook the bacon, so just pour some of that off into what you're going to make your chowder in, and then you've got, you know, a cut up onion, very small, and then I also cut the celery up about the same size, a couple stalks of celery, you know. Why are they not really stalks? They're stems of celery. You have the whole stalk, and then you have, I think, maybe it's not called the stem. I don't really know. But you need two of them, and chop them up just about the same size as the onion, and get going on that right away, and season it with salt and pepper. I usually throw in a few red pepper flakes, and then you can start chopping your carrot and potato, and I like the carrot and the potato to be the same size so that it cooks about the same time. So rather than have a big round chunk of carrot, you want less like another square piece. So cut your carrots in half, and then you can cut them in strips from there, and then turn them, and then cut them into smaller chunks. Smaller than, you know, a nice bite size. And same with the potatoes. And I use Yukon Gold potatoes. I like the firmness of the potatoes. So once your onion and celery have cooked and are translucent, then you can throw your potatoes in and your carrots. And they'll start releasing their juices, and the potatoes start to release some starch as well. And so that mixture is going to thicken up a little bit. And I put the lid on it, and I just let all that moisture just drip right back into the vegetables. And then they kind of steam and cook, and just watch them, stir them a little bit so they're not sticking to the bottom. And then I add in the bacon that I had cooked. I also add in some parsley. And this time I added a little bit of saffron. Just a pinch, and I let that sit in just a tablespoon of hot water first. When I first got started, I let it sit. So it's just going to release the flavor from the saffron. And then I pour that into there, too. So immediately you have that really great saffron smell. Not too much, but it's just a nice touch. It gives it a little bit of extra richness. So right now you've got that nice mixture going on, and you know, I like to have that thick mixture to start with. So once I know that my potatoes and carrots are cooked, after I've kept the lid on and the steam is happening, then I go ahead and add just a tablespoon of flour to it, mix it all up together, then it gets really thick. And that's when you pour in a little bit of wine, deglaze the pan, and then you've just got this nice wine-flavored thick mixture. And once that happens, then you're ready to go to add in your half and half or your whipping cream. You could add milk, but you need to be very careful that you don't boil it. But so I was making this for someone else, and I wanted it to be very decadent, so I added whipping cream and half and half. And then the mixture, just stir it occasionally, and it's going to start to thicken up, but not too much, and it's just the perfect consistency. For the halibut, I cut the halibut into nice chunks. And rather than just throw the halibut in the whole shebang, I decided I wanted to brown it first. So I had the nice chunks of halibut, and I seasoned them. So kind of almost like a blackened spice, but I used paprika, I used some onion powder and some garlic powder and some salt and pepper, a little bit of red pepper flakes, and coated the halibut chunks with that and put them in the cast iron skillet with some of that bacon grease and browned the chunks of halibut. I turned it on high and I pretty much seared the halibut and then flipped them over and seared the other side. I don't want to cook them all the way because I want it to cook in the broth, but searing the halibut gave it its own flavor to add to the soup, so you've got that layer of flavor. Throw your halibut, once it's done, into the pot with the rest, and it'll continue to cook. And try not to stir it too much. You don't want the halibut chunks to break up and turn into just all this flake. And there you have it. So seasoned to taste, I added some Worcestershire sauce to that. I also added a pinch of curry powder to give it that richness as well. Not too much. You don't want it to be curry soup, but... and then season to taste. And that was it. Oh my gosh, with fresh bread, delicious. And maybe a light salad on the side. So creamy halibut chowder. And I didn't write that recipe down, but I do have the recipe written as a clam chowder. If you want that, you can email mindy@kfsk.org and I'll get that to you. Coming up next on KFSK, a conversation with Heather Shade from the Port Chilcoot Distillery. And following that, just a few recipes that have gin and bourbon in it. That's coming up next on What's for Dinner. Support for What's for Dinner on KFSK comes from Inga's Galley, closed for the season. Heather and crew thanks Petersburg for a first great summer. Inga's Galley. Welcome back to What's for Dinner. I'm Mindy Anderson, your host. You know that gin that I talk about here on What's for Dinner during the drink of the week? Distilled in Haines. Well, we're going to hear about it, where it's made and who makes it. I have a conversation with Heather Shade from the Port Chilcoot Distillery in Haines. Located in the historical Port Chilcoot area of Haines, Alaska, Port Chilcoot Distillery is an artisanal micro-distillery owned and operated by husband and wife team Heather Shade and Sean Copeland. One of only a handful of women head distillers in the country, Heather heads up the recipes and the finer notes of the spirits as well as the eye-catching aesthetics of the bottle design, while Sean focuses on the barrel maturation process. The couple incorporates locally grown herbs with inspiration from Alaska's rugged and majestic homeland into sought-after Alaskan strength spirits in their Kentucky-made 125-gallon copper pot still. And last week I had the opportunity to speak with Heather about the Port Chilkoot Distillery and distilling spirits in Haines, Alaska. Thanks for joining us today, Heather. I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to us. Could you just tell the listeners here in Petersburg a little bit about yourself and what you're doing at the moment?
Sure. I'm Heather Shade. I live in Haines, which is where I'm calling in from. And my husband, Sean Copeland, and I have lived here for about 7 years. And a little over 3 years ago, we decided we wanted to do something completely different with our lives and something unique and interesting that would capture our passion for food and drinks and for small business. So what we did is start the Port Chilkoot Distillery here in Haines. A little less than 2 years ago, we opened our doors, and now we have an up-and-running business that makes distilled spirits right here in Haines that we distribute all over the state of Alaska. So we've got several projects going on right now. Our most well-known product, our 50 Fathoms Gin, which you may have had down there in Petersburg
by
now.
I talk about it all the time on What's for Dinner because I discovered it while I was in Juneau. Then I came back and I came onto my show and I was telling everybody about this. And now every time I go to get a bottle of it here in town, it's out. Then I have to wait and wait and wait.
Well, that's a big part of what we do is make that gin. So that takes up a lot of our time. The good thing about it is that it's really fun to make, and it makes the distillery smell really good when we're doing it.
Oh, yeah.
But it's really nice to hear from folks all over Alaska who enjoy it, and we get calls all the time about fun cocktails people are making in it or where they've shipped it off to somewhere in the world. So that's a big part of what we do. But we are making some other things we're about to release actually on the shelf as well.
How do you go about owning a distillery? I mean, you must have started a small batch somewhere. Were you guys just sitting around a campfire and decided, hey, let's make some gin? Or, did you start with a small little tiny little kit in your kitchen? How did you learn to distill spirits?
Well, it was really hard, actually, and I wouldn't recommend it. But we had become interested in it because we really like spirits. I really like mixing up different cocktails and trying whiskeys from all over the world. So a lot of our original interest in it was because we like to try something new all the time and regional things that you can't find anywhere else, or the local flavors of something that's made in a certain place. And we brew beer at home, and that's a very similar process. But when we were looking at creating jobs for ourselves and creating actually a business, we thought, well, why don't we try to make whiskey or something?
Uh-huh.
And we actually had no idea how to make it.
Wow.
We knew how to make beer, which is the first step in the process, and also, it turns out, a very important one. So at home, we were doing fermentation of grains, with yeast, experimenting with different grains, and making beer. When we were looking into taking it a step further and distilling it into spirits, we found out that it's actually illegal to distill at home in the United States.
Right, right.
Can't do it. So what we did is we started looking at the process of getting permits to do it legally at the same time that we were looking to start a business. And when we saw what it would take to get all those permits and actually do it legally, it kind of made sense to make that into our business. So when we got that idea, we went ahead and sent in our applications for permits. It's very expensive.
I'm sure.
full of red tape and bureaucracy. So we started that process, and it took months and months before that was going to be before those were going to be available for us to actually use. So in the meantime, we traveled around Pacific Northwest, other parts of the United States, and visited other small distilleries that had just started and that were looking at doing doing this at the same scale that we were looking at. At the same time, we also read every book that we could find on the process of making distilled spirits. So we read a lot. We talked with other distillers. I learned from online forums, especially ones out of New Zealand and some countries in Europe where it's legal to distill at home, and everybody does it.
Everybody,
you know, cooks down their own fruit and makes their own nice brandy and stuff. So it was a real huge learning process. So when our permits, and at the same time we had equipment designed specifically for our distillery to make the products that we had settled on making, which was a variety of products. So when it finally came down to it, we had our permits in hand, we had received all our equipment, and it's a huge process to have all of that installed and set up. So to be a real legitimate distillery, we really had to go through a huge process.
Sure, and you probably had to put a lot of money into it, too? I mean,
yeah,
it seems like it would be expensive.
We used all our savings, we took out a home loan, and we cashed out our retirement funds.
Okay.
To do this project.
That's gutsy.
Yeah. So we took a risk. We needed a building to house it in, and my husband, Sean, is a very fine carpenter. So we bought a run-down, very old historical building that was barely salvageable and built it ourselves. Designed, had the equipment designed specifically for us by this company in Kentucky who makes distillation equipment for all of the large distilleries there. Shipped it here, had it all installed, and throughout that whole year we had been just learning every possible thing that we could about making distilled spirits. At the same time, we were able to practice the cooking of the grains and the fermentation process, essentially the brewing.
Sure.
And it turns out that's of great importance because that's actually where all the flavors in the base spirit is created. So if you can brew and make good beer, that's half of it right there. And then we purchased neutral spirits that were already made, essentially vodka, and practice just infusing them with flavors at home, with herbs and fruits, and just to get a sense from on an experimental level of what kind of flavors do come through in alcohol. So we had those two pieces of knowledge going into the whole project, but when it finally came down to cooking our whole batch and doing the first run, we actually did a 250-gallon batch first thing. So we crossed our fingers, hoped we had learned everything properly, and just did it.
That's great.
We scaled up the recipes that we had been doing at home in 5-gallon buckets that we thought were turning out quite nice with the flavors and the aromas, and we scaled it up to a large batch and ran the still for the first time, and it worked.
How many people do you employ?
We do most of the work ourselves. We have one full-time employee, Mackie, who is our tasting room manager.
Uh-huh.
And then we have a part-time processing employee who helps us proof, gauge, and bottle the products. And we bring on volunteers to help with the bottling runs.
All right.
And then we're about to hire, hopefully, someone to help begin learning to make the whiskey and the spirits and help in production. But it's taken a while to get to that point.
Sure. It didn't take you very long to get 2 gold medals on your 50 Fathoms Gin. How do you feel about that? It must be amazing for you.
Oh, we were so proud of that. I mean, for about 6 months, everyone who tasted our gin told us it was just amazing and they loved it, and we loved it. You know, we made it to our tastes what we thought an amazing gin really should taste like. And so when we decided to enter it into a tasting competition, we were very selective about which one we entered it into. A lot of the tasting competitions, you know, kind of just give out medals, but we really wanted it to go in front of a panel of very respectable tasting judges. So we sent it to the American Craft Spirits Award, where it was awarded a gold medal. And when we got home with the gold medal, Sean said, well, maybe we should enter it into the World Spirits Competition. You know, we can at least get a bronze or something. And I thought, well, why not? It's a little expensive, but we'll ride on this gold medal and see what the World Spirits judges think. So we were super excited when it won a double gold medal at that, because it was competing with world-class gins.
Sure,
that you see all over the shelf. So we're really proud of our little gin.
Yeah.
We still make it the same way in small batches. We put the herbs in by hand, and we're just going to keep doing that because we think it's really good.
Because that works, yeah. So, Heather, how many batches do you think you've made so far, just of your gin? We'll talk about your other stuff here in a little bit, but since you started.
Just of the gin, I'd say we've made between 10 and 12 batches of the gin.
Okay. And how many bottles can you get out of that?
We get about... we get about 250 bottles from a batch.
Okay. All right, so...
Yeah, so we've made a couple thousand bottles of gin.
All right. Well, I feel very fortunate then that now we're drinking it and you've only made a few thousand bottles, so that's cool.
That's really fun. We get now that we have a tasting room and are selling it out of our distillery on site, we get a lot of phone calls from folks who visited our distillery throughout the summer, went home with a bottle, and now they've run out and are desperate to get more. So I'm constantly telling people that you can only get it in Alaska right now, so hopefully you made very good friends here who will send you some, or that you should come back.
Tell me a little bit about the herbs that you're using. Now, I'm assuming you use juniper, and you don't have to give us your whole entire recipe, but I know you probably use juniper, and are you using wild herbs that you're gathering or having somebody gather for you, or are you having somebody grow some of these for you?
A little bit of both.
Mm-hmm.
With the 50 Fathoms gin, we wanted it to be a London dry style gin, so juniper is the dominant ingredient in it. And we use a combination of cultivated juniper that we import and wild harvested juniper that we harvest ourselves. We find the wild harvested ones don't have as much of the traditional juniper oils in it that come through in the distillation, but they have a subtle, unique flavor that I think makes it really interesting.
Sure.
I won't give away the whole recipe because I worked very hard to create it myself,
mm-hmm.
but the second dominant herb in the gin is coriander.
Oh, okay.
That gives it a little bit of spice to balance out the juniper.
Yeah.
We also use cinnamon, cardamom, wild harvested spruce tips, a couple other herbs, and the real special ingredient in this gin is gold nugget tangerines. And these are grown by my family in Southern California, and they dry the rind of these tangerines and send them to us each year to make the gin. And it adds a real nice citrus finish to the gin that I really like. We're working with gardeners and farmers in Haines right now to grow a variety of other herbs that we've started experimenting with, mostly for an absinthe product that we're just releasing this week. And we are able to harvest wild herbs, and we use those mainly in our tasting room to experiment with cocktails and infusing herbs into new products. And right now we're still kind of, you know, since we do have a couple products out there now, we're able to spend more and more time experimenting and do doing product development and working with new flavors now.
So thinking about product development, now you have a mash left over, right?
Mm-hmm.
Are you have you thought about anything to use the mash with yet? Are you, what are you doing with that?
Right now it's being composted
mm-hmm.
by gardeners and going to folks who are raising pigs to use as pig feed. But I was just talking with somebody who had made bread from
uh-huh.
spent brewery mash in the past, and I think that would be a really neat use of it because we generate a lot of it, and the grains themselves still have a lot of flavor and use to them. So I think that would be a neat thing to do, especially now that we're working with a lot of rye grain.
I think
it
would be
great. But I haven't found anybody to do that yet.
Oh, I'd love to have some. I'd try it in some of this multi-grain bread that I've been making that uses a rye flour, and then I soak the seeds ahead of time, a lot of grains, for like an hour. But, a cup full of that mash would be great.
Oh, it would be so interesting.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
We use a variety of grains. We use corn, wheat, barley, and rye right now.
Great.
So it could even be a multi-grain bread.
So I just want to let people know, too, that you make the Icy Straight vodka, and people have probably seen that here in town. And you also do, you have the 12 volts moonshine.
Mm-hmm.
And then I noticed you have a 6 volts moonshine. I've never had your moonshine before. But a 6 volts moonshine, which is a little bit smaller bottle, of course, about half the size.
Mm-hmm. Yep, it's actually just the same product,
okay.
but half the size.
Okay.
So the moonshine, is actually an unaged corn whiskey. So it's made from corn and barley. And that product we did just kind of for fun. It was
uh-huh.
it was a really lighthearted project, and we've had a lot of fun with it in the tasting room in our cocktails because it has some unique characteristics. So when you smell the moonshine, it has kind of a tequila-like nose.
Ah.
So it goes well in cocktails that you would traditionally use tequila in, like margaritas. But then on the flavor, it has a real grain whiskey flavor. So we can use it equally in things like whiskey sours, which is what we do with it a lot in the tasting room. But it was it's the precursor to our bourbon whiskey, which we've just started selling by the bottle in Haines. So our first product that we actually made in the distillery was a bourbon whiskey that we've been making and barreling in single batches for 2 years now, and maturing in oak barrels in the distillery. So that's a really special product that we're just now starting to release in the bottle in single barrel batches.
I was just telling somebody about that before we started our conversation, that you had a batch of bourbon that you started a couple of years ago. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. I can't wait to taste that, if there's any left, if Haynes doesn't drink it all.
It's really good. So we emptied our first barrel a couple months ago just to serve out of our tasting room at Haynes. And the empty barrel itself went to the Haynes Brewing Company, where they filled it with their Black Fang Imperial Stout. So they barrel-aged a beer in the empty barrel that our bourbon was in. And that was amazing.
That's great. That's great.
And then we've emptied two barrels since then. And the latest one that we just bottled, and there's some left of it, but Haynes is buying it up pretty quickly, is the third barrel we've emptied, and it's our best so far. So I think
okay.
they're just going to keep getting better and better. We've put up a few barrels every month since we opened, as we could afford it. So that'll be coming out hopefully soon around Southeast Alaska.
Are you going to enter that one into a competition, Heather?
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I think that one will do well. And then we started working with rye grain, which I love because rye has such neat, spicy characteristics, and I think that one's going to be an award winner.
I can't let you go today without maybe getting a recipe from you for one of your favorite drinks with whichever spirit you want to use. Do you have a favorite one you want to tell us about? And I know people can go to your website. You've got recipes
mm-hmm.
there as well. That's the PortChilcootDistillery.com.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe you could share one with us.
Sure. You know, in our tasting room here in the distillery, we work with all kinds of flavors. We've made syrups out of fireweed and red currants and infused nettles and spruce tips and everything in our spirits. But I tend to be a traditionalist, and our gin, I think, really doesn't need much added to it to make a great cocktail because it's already so flavorful mm-hmm. on its own. So my favorite go-to for the 50 Fathoms gin is a gin fizz. So I'll take a fresh egg white, an ounce of simple syrup, half of a lemon squeezed into a tin, and 2 ounces of gin. Shake it up really vigorously without any ice for about 30 seconds, and then I'll add ice into the tin and shake it another dozen times, strain it into an old-fashioned glass, and garnish it with a dash of bitters, and it's just a nice, frothy, refreshing gin drink.
Mmm, yes, it sounds delicious. We'll have to try it. And so at your tasting room, you actually serve these drinks?
We do, yeah. We have some signature drinks that we do here because we have another local company in Haines making all kinds of syrups specifically for our tasting room from wild harvested berries and herbs. So our signature drink in the tasting room right now is a Highbush cranberry gimlet, which is made with either a vodka or gin with cranberry syrup, cranberry bitters, lime, and cranberry juice. But we also we serve cocktails made with wild rose syrup, fireweed, spruce tip infused vodka, all kinds of neat things. We're
nice.
Always experimenting with something, and Mackie, our bartender and tasting room manager, is very creative. So if anyone ever gets the chance to come in here, we can even experiment with new flavors.
Oh, nice, nice. Before I let you go, Heather, have you ever cooked with your gin or any of your spirits before? Do you use them at home to cook with? Do you make sauces, desserts?
You know, I haven't had much of a chance even to cook since starting this whole project because we're constantly making the spirits. So the only opportunity I've had to use the gin has been I've whipped it into a frosting for some cupcakes at one time, which is very good. And I made a meat demi-glaze with the moonshine. But now that we have aged whiskey, I use that, which makes a really nice addition to gravies and sauces.
Sure, yeah.
But no, we haven't had the chance to yet.
I can see it with venison and huckleberries or maybe rose hips. There's lots of rose hips out there right now. So and really good cuts of red meat. I'm looking forward to trying that with some fresh venison, I hope, if we get a fresh deer this year.
Oh, I could see it going so well with
that. Oh, yeah.
Oh, and I hope you do.
Yes, a pheasant, which we can't get around here. But Heather, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I wish you the best of luck in everything you do. And I'm going to get up there to Haines and get a tour of your distillery.
You can help us make a batch sometime.
That would be great. And maybe I can grab a cup of that mash to throw in some bread.
We have buckets of it.
All right. Thanks. And don't forget, everybody, you can find them on the web at PortChilcootDistillery.com. Take care, Heather.
Thanks, Mindy. Good talking with you.
And thanks to Heather Shade for the conversation last week about brewing or distilling spirits up there in Haines. And coming up next, I'm just going to give you a quick recipe for a gin sauce that can go with all your wild game that you're hunting for this season. That's coming up next on What's for Dinner. ¶¶ support for What's for Dinner comes from Keto's Cave and Liquor Store on Singley Alley and hosting a fall wine tasting event on Friday, September 25th, beginning at 6 p.m. and featuring wines all day in the liquor store. Keto's Cave and Liquor Store on Singley Alley and open 7 days a week. Okay, so while you're out there deer hunting, moose hunting, duck hunting, all of this, all of those meats would go really well with a good juniper gin sauce. And so you need some juniper berries, 6 to 10 juniper berries. Just pick a little handful of them. And then you need some red wine, about a half of a cup of red wine. Also, you're going to need some stock. So a venison stock would be great to use, moose stock if you're, you know, if you've got those bones. You can also use pan juices if you didn't make a stock, and or you can use a chicken stock or a beef stock as well. You also need some butter, about a tablespoon, a couple of minced shallots, some gin. You're going to need quarter cup of gin and some salt and ground pepper. So basically you can crush your juniper berries. You can use a knife, you can use whatever you need to crush them. Just don't pulverize them, but crush them a little bit, put them in a small saucepan with the red wine and let them infuse in the red wine, and let that red wine cook down to about half, and it's going to get kind of syrupy. Then add your stock. You're going to need about a cup of stock, and cook that down until it's reduced, and set that aside. So you have a nice red wine, juniper, reduced stock, delicious. If you want to use some rose hips instead, like I'd mentioned earlier, that would work too. Then in a small saucepan or a saute pan, you can melt some butter and then add your shallots. So you have that nice shallot butter. Cook that for a couple of minutes and let them become nice and soft. And then you're going to remove the pan from the heat and add your gin to the pan. That's with the butter and the shallots. And because you don't really want the alcohol, you mostly want the flavor, which this gin has great flavor. So you can ignite it. Many times that when you're cooking with alcohol, it'll just light on fire anyway, just from the heat of the pan, especially if you move it all over to one side and add your gin. But just make sure you're not, looking right over the pan, because it will flame up and then it'll go out. Or you can light it with a long-handled match if you want. And once the flames have gone down, you just stir it a little bit, add your reserved wine and stock mixture to that, and it'll be a nice thick, sauce. It'll coat the side of the spoon. You can drain it through a little sieve to remove the shallots, and it'll also remove the juniper berries as well, and return it to a saucepan. You can serve that with venison, moose. You could serve it with duck or geese. So a lot you can serve it with. Also, like I said before, pheasant as well. You can serve it with a nice cut of beef. That sauce will go a long way with a lot of different foods. And, of course, you can kind of make a gin. I've talked about my sauce that is the cream sauce that I make with tequila. And you could do the same thing with gin on that as well. Saute. Well, I use tomatillos and olive oil and butter and shallots or onions and some garlic and saute all of that together and put it in, put a little gin in it and let that all cook together. Put it in the blender after you let it cool just a little bit and then add your cream to it. And you have a nice creamy white sauce, which goes really well with fish. Tuna, even chicken. you know, it would be super great on chicken. And that's all we have time for recipes, cooking with the spirits today, but maybe we'll come back to that at some point. But before we go, coming up here, I want to give you this recipe. You know, we're going to hang on to summer. We're just going to hang on to it. And grilled peach cobbler, delicious. The peaches are still great, and I'm just addicted to them right now. So I'm still going to be cooking with peaches with a grilled peach cobbler. You can take about 6 ripe peaches, cut them in half, remove the pit, put them on the grill upside down so that they grill, and it just needs to be for just a few minutes. Then you can cut them into wedges and put them in a bowl. Add some butter, like about 4 tablespoons of butter, and some brown sugar, maybe 4 tablespoons of brown sugar, and a half a teaspoon of cinnamon, and toss all of that together, butter, brown sugar, and cinnamon. And then you're going to take, once again, some butter, about 4 tablespoons of melted butter, about 4 tablespoons of sugar, and a half a teaspoon of cinnamon to a half a cup of granola, and mix all that together. Put the peaches in a cast iron skillet and top the peaches with the granola mixture. And, you know, you could use honey. I mean, you know, change it up. And put that into your cast iron skillet and put that on your grill. Close the lid and bake it until the peaches and granola are golden brown, only about 15 minutes or so. And then, of course, you get a nice shallow bowl, wide bowl, and you put a big scoop of ice cream in there, and you scoop those peaches on top and drizzle it with maybe a little bit of cream or possibly a caramel sauce, and that sounds delicious to me. Nice and warm dessert. That's it today for What's for Dinner. Thanks to the Port Chilcoot Distillery. Thanks, Heather, for joining me. I had gin and tonic this weekend. Actually, I had 2. So thank you. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with more food and recipes. Until then, happy eating and happy cooking.